You're listening to American Songcatcher, tracing the roots of American music from its cultured past to today's artists playing it forward. I'm folk musician Nicholas Edward Williams. From Pennsylvania, running west and clear down to its mouth at the mighty Mississippi River, the Ohio River is nearly 1,000 miles long and is cloaked with history. Before settlers arrived, Native Americans used the river for trade and travel between communities for thousands of years, and later it became a battleground during the French and Indian War. More and more settlers landed and claimed their territory as the river became an essential trade route for both goods and the selling of slaves down south.
Caroline, that would be fine, any place below the Dixon line.
Throughout the 1800s, the river wasn't just a division between states. It also drew a line between the opinions on slavery, both north and south of it. Considered the western extension of the Mason-Dixon line, free states above and slave states below, the Ohio River was the essential door, both before and during the Civil War, for slaves to escape north through the Underground Railroad. It's estimated that thousands made the arduous journey across those waters, more than anywhere else in the eastern half of the country. In slave states, it was against the law to teach the enslaved to read or write, so songs became essential to share messages and information about escaping, or to ensure safe travel. Abolitionist, writer, and former slave Frederick Douglass gave this example of how a song could be used as encouragement for a group of slaves to finalize an escape. A keen observer might have detected in our repeated singing of "O Canaan, sweet Canaan, I thought I heard them say, there were lions in the way, I don't expect to stay much longer here." In the lips of our company, it simply meant a speedy pilgrimage toward a free state and deliverance from all the evils and dangers of slavery. Additionally, Underground Railroad conductor Harriet Tubman said that she used a biblical spiritual song called "Go Down Moses" to communicate with fugitive slaves who were escaping from Maryland, and her code name was Moses. Harriet also used another African-American spiritual turned map song called "Wade in the Water," where the directions were coded in the lyrics, telling the enslaved listener that they could avoid being seen by getting into the water. Another song used in the Underground Railroad was called "Follow the Drinking Gourd," collected by an amateur folklorist named H.B. Parks in the early 1900s. He told the following story of a man named Peg Leg Joe, who was a solo operative of the Underground Railroad. One of my great uncles, who was connected with the railroad movement, remembered that in the records of the Anti-Slavery Society, there was a story of a Peg Leg sailor, known as Peg Leg Joe, who made a number of trips through the South and induced young Negroes to run away and escape. Starting near Mobile, Alabama, the trail described in the song followed northward to the headwaters of the Tom Bigbee River, thence over the Divide and down the Ohio River to Ohio. The Peg Leg sailor would teach this song to young slaves and show them the mark of his natural left foot and the round hole made by his peg leg. He would then go ahead of them northward and leave a print made of charcoal and mud of the outline of a human left foot and a round spot in place of the right foot. The song's reference to the drinking gourd, as Peg Leg told them, could be found by looking up at the stars to the Big Dipper, aligning closely with Polaris, also known as the North Star, and follow it to Ohio, to freedom. When they reached the banks of the Ohio River on this perilous journey, hundreds of runaways would set up camp and have meetings. For affirmation, comfort, and out of necessity for the times, they would listen to a traveling preacher share the gospel. As the sermon built in intensity and the congregation grew more vocal, breaking into song was commonplace. And whether they used words from the sermon or out in the fields prior, many spiritual songs were created in these camps. While some could easily be forgotten, others were so memorable that they were sustained through generations, then elaborated on to fit the changing circumstances. One such spiritual that is thought to have been passed in this way was eventually called "Down by the Riverside."
Down by the riverside, lay down my
The earliest hints of the song can be traced to Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4 in the Bible. "And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." These Bible verses and religious themes would become central to different versions of the song, such as "Ain't Gonna Study War No More" and "Gonna Cross That River of Jordan, Down by the Riverside." This referred directly to the Ohio River, which the enslaved considered their River of Jordan for a few reasons. Number one, in the Old Testament, the river is the Hebrews' final passage before entering the Promised Land after spending many years wandering in the desert. Number two, entering the water was considered a baptism, and the Southern Baptist renditions of the song had verses like, "Gonna put on my long white robe." And number three, the reference could be used as code in song to relay information, much like Harriet Tubman's use of "Go Down Moses" and "Wade in the Water."
Gonna meet in my mother down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Gonna meet my...
The first publication of "Down by the Riverside" came in 1918 in the book "Plantation Melodies, a Collection of Modern, Popular, and Old-Time Negro Songs." 2 years later, the first known recording of the song was by the Fisk University Jubilee Quartet in 1920. While spiritual songs such as "Down by the Riverside" provided a map for safe passage, they also gave the emotional support that enslaved people needed to be resilient in extremely tumultuous times. The songs they sang of freedom throughout the 1800s and after the Civil War were a direct catalyst to inspire black communities to vie for long overdue equality during the Civil Rights Movement, and provided a landing pad for their white allies to rally from. Over a century after its inception, the song came to prominence in mainstream America during the 1960s for both the Civil Rights Movement as well as a protest song against the Vietnam War due to its pacifist tone. "Down by the Riverside," also at times called "Gonna Lay Down My Burden" or "Ain't Gonna Study War No More," has been recorded by Louis Armstrong, Pete Seeger, Nat King Cole, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Big Bill Brunzi, Lead Belly, Mahalia Jackson, Van Morrison, Etta James, and the Million Dollar Quartet, featuring Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Carl Perkins. The song is still sung at gatherings around the world where wars are being fought and where people yearn for peace. Here's my rendition of "Down by the Riverside," inspired by a mix of Big Bill Brunzi's music and Lead Belly's lyrics.
I'm gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside. I'm gonna study, oh, no more. I ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more, no more. I ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Study, oh, no more. Well, I'm gonna put on my long white robe down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna put on my long white robe down by the riverside. I'm gonna study, oh, no more. I ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Study, oh, no more, no more. Gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Well, I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. I'm gonna study, oh, no more. I ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study, oh, no more, no more. I'm gonna study, oh, no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Take your arm from around my neck and take sugar, babe. Take your wing from around my neck, now sugar, babe. Take your arms around my neck, you just got me a little upset. Almost send you right back to Georgia, sugar, babe.
In a broad valley of southeast Texas called the Brazos Bottoms, Bodie Glenn Lipscomb, better known as Mance Lipscomb, came into the world on April 9th, 1895. His father was a former slave in Alabama, acquiring the last name after being sold as a boy to a Texas family named Lipscomb. And his mother was half native Choctaw Indian, who was sought after locally for knowing when to put plants in the ground. He joined his mother in the fields at age 10, picking 50 pounds of cotton a day. And by 16, he was doing 500 pounds a day. Mance's family was very musical. His father was a fiddle player, his brothers were guitarists, and his uncle was a banjo player. His father taught him the fiddle when he was young, and around 11 years old, his mother got him a three-string guitar on credit for $1.50, 3 days' pay in the cotton field. He taught himself to play and soon surpassed his brothers, like a car passing a tramp, as he said, and was able to accompany his father. One of the first tunes that he learned early on was the traditional folk blues song, Sugar Babe.
Sugar babe, I'm tired of you. Ain't your honey but the way you do. Sugar babe, it's all over now.
Mance was eventually in high demand around the Grimes County area in Texas because he played songs that made people want to dance. And for several decades, he only performed locally for Saturday night suppers that he and his wife organized and was paid $1.50 for the performances. There was no amplification or speakers, so it was a matter of singing and playing as hard and loud as he could as a performer. And oftentimes, these went on until the early hours of Sunday. As more and more musicians began to travel to smaller towns in the wake of the minstrel and vaudeville circuits, they would get into conversation with locals about what musicians were known around town. Word about Mance got to the father of country music, Jimmy Rogers, who asked Mance to go on tour in 1922, but he declined because, as he said, he was just a country boy and didn't know much about the outside world. Though he rarely left the area until the 1960s, he did get out a few times and even met Blind Lemon Jefferson around 1917 in the Deep Ellum area of Dallas, Texas, as well as Lightnin' Hopkins in Galveston, Texas, around 1938.
Yes, Isaac, go bring me my shotgun. Boy, bring me back some shell.
Mance got married to his lifelong partner, Eleonora, around 1913, and they had one son, Mance Jr. In 1956, Mance punched a white foreman named Tom Moore, who was mistreating both Eleonora and his mother while working on Moore's farm. This caused him to leave town quickly, and he ended up in Houston for the next 2 years, finding day work at a lumberyard and performing in the evenings at bars along with Lightnin' Hopkins. He later recorded a ballad about how bad it was there, titled Tom Moore's Farm, though it was released anonymously for his own protection. He received some workers' comp from an accident on the job, and along with some savings, Mance went back to Navasota, where he was able to buy land and build his own home.
Move my woman down on Mr. Tom Moore's farm. Start to work in the morning, don't stop till 1 o'clock.
In 1960, while Mance was working for a local highway mowing crew, two blues researchers from the now legendary R. Hooley Records came around town looking for Lightnin' Hopkins, who had just left the area. Word of mouth led them to Mance instead, who is now 65 years old. They agreed to listen to him, and an impromptu performance was recorded around Mance's kitchen table, which gave birth to both his and R. Hooley Records' debut release, called Mance Lipscomb, Texas Songster and Sharecropper.
This is a number composed, a fellow wrote it, on his sickbed confession. But I'm going down slow. I've had my fun if I don't get well no more. I done had my fun if I don't get well no more.
Mance's first big appearances were at the Texas Heritage Festival in Houston in 1960 and 1961, then 3 years straight at the revered Berkeley Folk Festival between 1961 and 63, playing for a crowd of over 40,000 people. where he said, "I never did look up because I was just chilled through. I didn't know whether the guitar was tuned up or not. I just blammed away on it and tried to get something out of it." Between festivals, he joined the folk coffee house circuit around California and added to his recording catalog with Arhuli Records. It didn't take long for the mostly white audiences and other blues and folk musicians around at the time to take notice of what he was doing. Mann stood out from other performers because of his massively diverse repertoire of over 350 songs, performing ballads, waltzes, Texas blues, spirituals, two-steps, children's songs, jigs, rags, reels, polkas, and more. He'd also give examples of songs and dances that have both white and black roots, and especially preserved African-American dance forms and styles that predate the mainstream popularity of the blues. As he stated in his memoir, which is called "I Say For Me a Parable," it was a true story song, or nothing but a cow hunting for a calf. You gotta be unsatisfied to have the blues.
Ain't it hard, 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 ain't it hard.
By the late 1960s, Mance had released six albums, mostly with Arhuli Records. His interest in the blues was peaking, so was his career, appearing at the Festival of American Folklife, the Ann Arbor Blues Festival, the Monterey Folk Festival, and the acclaimed Newport Folk Festival. He was there in 1965 when Bob Dylan was booed off stage for going electric, and said about him, "That young kid, Dylan, he's a real nice young fella. He's written some real good songs, too. I'm crazy about them. He used to follow me around out in California when I was playing there a few years ago. He'd be real quiet and just watch. You know, he's a quick boy to catch on." At nearly 80 years old, in the mid-1970s, Mance began to have heart problems, and his declining health caused him to retire from performing in 1974. After suffering a stroke that confined him to full-time care for the following 2 years, Mance Lipscomb passed away at Grimes Memorial Hospital in Navasota on January 30th, 1976. Mance represents a window into the musical culture of African Americans before the blues became a dominant genre. In contrast to the stereotypes and the characterizations of blues musicians, Mance didn't gamble, never used drugs, rarely drank, and he was a staunch family man who stayed with his wife, Elnora, his entire life and helped raise 23 children, only one of which was his own. He may have sang and played the blues, but he much preferred to be called a songster, a more accurate description given his wide range of material that was popular at the turn of the century.
Boy, you know, when your girl quit you and you ain't got nobody to talk to and you're feeling blue, tell you what you have to do now to think about her. Say, you know, when last night I had a good girlfriend and now tonight I ain't got none. Somebody be talking and say, well, I'll tell you, say, if I had one tonight, so I sure would treat her right. This boy said, well, if I had one any day, I'd treat her right. This is nighttime, it's the right time to be with the one you love. Any time of day, any time of night, it'd be all right if you get that gal.
Mance also preserved a sense of how individual entertainers managed to keep the attention of any crowd. Just as much as he was admired for his virtuosic and diverse song catalog, Mance made fans with his poetic and eloquent life observations, what's been termed front porch philosophizing, that he may have learned from his father. Sayings like, if you can't pay a man in full, you pay him in distance. And, you just try to live right. One of these days, a little right coming to you. His memoir is actually an unedited oral autobiography titled, I Say For Me a Parable, compiled from conversations with Texas author and collaborator Glenn Allen. Mance agreed to being recorded on the condition that the two share any profits from the book equally. It was published 17 years after his death, in 1993. Allen split the profits with Mance's family, and later it won a Music Book of the Year award from the ASCAP Music Licensing Agency.
You know, this world was made for you and me. It don't belong to me alone. It don't belong to you. It belongs to everybody. Now, people don't see it. They say, well, I got a part of the world that belongs to me over here. Maybe I'm going to take the world and run it like I want to. But when you get that in your mind, you ain't gonna get nowhere.
I'm faded, jank, and strength.
and a drag never went a thing. Jack a diamond was a hard heart to beat.
Mance also appeared in several films, including starring in a Les Blank documentary in 1971 called A Well Spent Life. Mance demonstrated his use of a pocket knife as a slide, as he did on old traditional tunes like Jack of Diamonds, which you're hearing right now. He had fans like Americana singer-songwriter Steve Earle, who wrote in a No Depression article that any Lipscomb recording is a case study in how to get folks up and out of their seats, armed only with a single guitar. The truth was, if you had Mance, you didn't need a band. Mance worked with Willie Nelson, Pete Seeger, and the Grateful Dead. Even Frank Sinatra persuaded his own label, Reprise, to record Mance's album, Trouble in Mind, American Folk Song Traditionalist, in 1961. The annual Navasota Blues Festival honors his legacy, and in 2011, a 300-pound bronze sculpture of him sitting on a bench playing guitar was unveiled in Mance Lipscomb Park in Navasota, where admirers can sit next to him and play their favorite tunes. Here's my rendition of Take Me Back, Baby, a Piedmont blues tune that Mance said was one of the oldest songs he remembers learning back in his early days.
Oh, baby, take me back. I won't do nothing that you don't like. I went down the railroad track, begging my baby to take me back. Take me back, me one more time. I won't do nothing to worry your mind. Torch your water, baby, cut your wood. Make your fire if I could. Oh, baby, didn't you say you're gonna let me have my own way? Tain't but the one thing that grieved my mind. My woman quit me in the winter time. So kill your chicken and save me the wing. You think I'm working, ain't doing a thing. I got it good. Name is Mark, works over yonder in the white folks' yard. She rushed me chicken, rushed me a goose, a precious little turkey, but ain't no use. Take me back, won't do nothing, baby, you don't like.
Ramblin' Jack Elliott started out life not as Ramblin' Jack, nor even Jack Elliott, but as Elliott Charles Adnepas. Born to Florence and luminary doctor Abraham Adnepas in Brooklyn, New York, on August 31, 1931, many of Elliott's formative years were colored by the rodeos he saw at Madison Square Garden. Throughout his tenure at Minwood High School, where he would graduate in 1949, Elliott Adnepas wanted to be a cowboy.
Oh, say, little doggies, why don't you lay down?
In fact, despite the inevitable pressure from his father to pursue a career in medicine, Elliott rebelled and left home at 15 to be a cowboy during World War II. Speaking to Rolling Stone in 2019, Elliott admitted that, "I didn't have any sort of plan, I just left home." In a move which could have been made by any number of characters in a classic folk tales that he still sings about, Elliott soon joined Colonel Jim Eskew's rodeo near Washington, D.C., which proudly boasted its existence as the only circus of its kind east of the Mississippi. Started by the likes of Wild Buffalo Bill, who cashed in on the near mythological aura surrounding the Old West, these traveling shows were making a resurgence amid the cowboy boom of the 30s and 40s.
Hello, Sheriff. I'm on my way to Deadwood. If you want me, come over and get me.
She didn't even tell me that she was leaving me. Now I'm the lonesomest cowboy down in the cow country.
Despite being far from his childhood ideals of roaming the prairies and the plains of the West, Elliot does remember watching Brahma Rogers, a rodeo clown that was entertaining the circus's crew with songs on a guitar and a banjo. The impact that this would have on the young teenager's life is immeasurable. In a time before Elvis and Johnny Cash were making kids everywhere eager to pick up the guitar, young Elliot Adnapaz knew that he had to learn that instrument.
There is a man you'll hear about most every place you go.
His parents, distraught and desperate, soon began distributing flyers of their missing son that would eventually lure him back home after 3 months of traveling the eastern seaboard. Though he returned, it wasn't long before he resumed his roving once again, singing and playing guitar first as Charles Adnapaz, which Elliot said he thought sounded cool, before settling on Buck Elliot. It was Elliot's visit to his friend Odetta's home, though, whereby the man we know today was christened. Knocking on her door, Elliot remembers Odetta's mother exclaiming from the other side that that Ramblin' Jack had come for her. Elliot's now infamous prefix, Ramblin', came about not as a remark on his itinerant lifestyle, but as a result of the already sophisticated and nebulous storytelling for which he was garnering a reputation.
Ramblin' around your city, ramblin' around your town.
Performing and busking an already substantial repertoire of music, it was inevitable that young Jack Elliot would cross paths with folk titan Woody Guthrie around 1950. He had obtained Woody's phone number from Tom Paley of the new Lost City Ramblers, and summoning the courage to call his hero, Elliot professed his admiration. True to character, Woody responded, "Well, Jack, you ought to come over and bring your guitar and we'll knock off a couple tunes together. Don't come today, though. I got a bellyache." That bellyache turned out to be appendicitis. And so it was then that Elliot first met his idol in person, recovering in a Brooklyn hospital. Jack recalled Woody being pretty dopey and mumbling about not making too much noise. Woody's wife Marjorie showed Jack Elliot around their Mermaid Avenue apartment, where like a kid in a candy store, he saw Woody's famous folk weapon, a guitar bearing the phrase, "This machine kills fascists."
Put it there, boy, and we'll show these fascists what a couple of hillbillies can do.
As an admirer and a student, Elliot went about learning all he could from his teacher, even so far as moving in with the family. So studious was he that Woody's own son, Arlo, admits that he learned Woody's way of playing and performing almost exclusively from Elliot, following his father's premature passing. In fact, Arlo remembers his father telling people that Elliot sounded more like me than I do, and Arlo could speak to Elliot's already larger-than-life idiosyncrasies, including the time that Jack turned up at their home in a telephone repair truck that he converted into a camper.
I watched him play for really well for about 2 years, 51 and 52. I guess it wasn't until about 1954 that he started to kind of lose the guitar picking end of it. He did some things on the guitar that I still cannot do, although I could hear how it sounded. Well, one of them was... couldn't get him to teach it to me, or somehow, you know, he'd let me learn something. I say, "Hey, how you do that?" He'd say, "Just watch it and steal it." He says, "I ain't gonna show it to you. Lead Belly, let me steal from him and you can steal from me. I ain't gonna show you nothing."
I've been having some hard traveling, I thought you knew. I've been hitting some hard traveling way down the road.
Ramblin' Jack would often turn up to the Guthrie household in a Model T Ford as his new converted camper, and take the children on long drives out to Long Island. Arlo Guthrie could never quite understand why he would stop every so often and fill up with 20 cents worth of gas. His best guess was that, as an uninhibited storyteller, Elliot just wanted to talk to people and exchange stories. You might remember from episode 4 in season 1, covering Woody's life, that due to what is now understood to be the first symptoms of the neurological disorder Huntington's, which would later take his life, Woody left his family and went with Jack Elliot as a sidekick to travel California and Florida. Surrounded by the Pacific Redwoods and beside the waters of the Gulf and the Atlantic, Woody imparted his mannerisms, his iconic inflections, and his extensive catalog of songs, including "This Land Is Your Land" and his collection of Dust Bowl ballads, all to the impressionable Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Desert sands they roll, gotta get out of the old dust bowl to think they're coming to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find.
It was in California that Woody met his second wife, Annika Van Kirk, and in a perturbed state, Woody was always concerned that his 21-year-old Belle would leave him for the youthful and comparatively healthy 22-year-old Elliot. He's never forgotten the feeling that he should have taken off due to this tension between him and Woody. In 1954, Jack Elliott went to practice what had been preached to him, and toured Appalachia for nearly a year. He spent much of this time immersed in the region's significant musical, cultural, and historical heritage, collecting a myriad of traditional songs and even more stories. His time down south also yielded the opportunity to learn firsthand from the likes of champion Jack Dupree, Sonny Terry, and Leadbelly.
I had a gal. Oh, what a gal. And her name was Sadie Brown. I took her out.
After marrying in 1955, Jack Elliott ventured across the ocean to the United Kingdom, as well as Europe, to foster his authentic blues and folk set. While performing in London, Mick Jagger remembered buying his first guitar as a result of watching Elliott play. By 1960, he had already recorded three albums for the London-based Topic Records, fully in his element among the emergent folk scene of the British metropolis, playing seedy dive bars by day, and then soaking in the unique glamour of the city's cabaret clubs at nightfall.
Won't you come and be my ball and chain? Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a dying and it's hardly been born.
On his return to the United States in 1961, Elliott's first priority was to head straight from his ship to a New Jersey hospital, where Woody was in the tight grip of Huntington's disease. He was walking like a drunk, if he walked at all, and Elliott lamented how you had to be very patient to understand what he said. Oddly, it was there that Ramblin' Jack discovered that he was now well-known within American folk circles. The main catalyst was a young troubadour out of Duluth, Minnesota, who had recently moved to Greenwich Village in New York City, named Robert Allen Zimmerman, better known as the freewheeling Bob Dylan. The two met for the first time at Woody's bedside that year, and Dylan was nearly as much of a fan of Elliott as he was of Woody, firing off obscure tracks from some of his earliest albums. With Woody's health in decline and eventual passing in 1967, the mantle of the folk elder statesman was officially passed to Ramblin' Jack, who took the young Bob Dylan under his wing.
Fishing down in a muddy bank, I felt a pull and a give a big yank, and I jerked out two old rubber boots and a Ford radiator and a Chevrolet coupe.
Throughout the 1960s, it appeared to many that Ramblin' Jack Elliott would reach mainstream popularity. He signed to Warner Brothers and with them released one of his most acclaimed albums, Young Brigham, in 1968. The cover was as iconic as the songs in it, with Ramblin' Jack saddled on a horse and roping the camera taking the picture. When he bought that horse, Elliott was told by the salesman that the horse feed would be tax deductible if the creature was on the album cover, though Ramblin' Jack never did remember to use that tax deduction. Even his daughter Ayana, born around the same time as the album's release, remembers her first words for her father as Horsey Man. The album showcased three traditionals, as well as covers of Tim Hardin, Woody Guthrie, and the Rolling Stones, all leading to a landmark appearance playing with Johnny Cash on his weekly television show. And Johnny introduced him like this.
I've done a lot of traveling in my time, any place I guess that you could mention, from Maine to California, to Alaska, to Europe, to Asia. Done a lot of traveling, but nobody I know, and I mean nobody, has covered more ground and made more friends and sung more songs than the fellow you're just about to meet right now. He's got a song and a friend for every mile behind him. Say hello to my good buddy, Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
By 1975, Bob Dylan and Patti Smith appeared at one of Elliott's shows and outlined a plan to tour smaller theaters. Within weeks, Elliott was on the road again as part of the traveling circus known as the Rolling Thunder Review, or as Elliott remembers it, the 31 days that nearly killed everybody on tour.
Just let me love you tonight.
He admitted to Rolling Stone that he doesn't remember being that intense, as shown in Martin Scorsese's documentary, Following the Tour, though he does remember that there is copious amounts of whiskey being passed around, leading him to being wired, and refers to this period as his druggiest. He witnessed Joni Mitchell write her seminal hit, Coyote, on the tour, and became acquainted with Bob Weir, guitarist for the Grateful Dead, in a dressing room. Above all else, though, the tour took its toll on everyone, and by the end of it, everyone was fried.
Set out running, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. If I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight.
True to his moniker, Ramblin' Jack continued telling stories and spreading songs throughout the 80s and resided in Texas for much of the decade. However, from a recording perspective, this period in the Lone Star State was far from prolific. The years of being burned by a whole host of labels was beginning to take its toll, though he did earn a Grammy Award for Best Traditional Folk Album on the 1995 record South Coast, his first record in 14 years. Following that, in 1998, he released Friends of Mine, which featured collaborations with Emmylou Harris, John Prine, Bob Weir, Nancy Griffith, Guy Clark, Peter Rowan, Tom Waits, and others. That same year, President Bill Clinton awarded him with the Presidential Medal of the Arts, adding, "In giving new life to our most valuable musical traditions, Ramblin' Jack has himself become an American treasure."
A dollar, I'd make it rain. If it rained an ocean, I'd drink it dry and lay me down to satisfy.
In his 60s, Elliott could still tour and party with the rest of them. Folk musician Todd Snyder remembers drinking with Elliott at an Austin hotel until the sun came up, recalling how he could play just as well at 4 a.m. as he could any other time. Around these years, Jack was dealt with a string of hard times. In 2001, Elliott's fifth wife, Janice, passed away. Just a week later, Elliott was opening for Merle Haggard, who was as sympathetic and consoling as his shyness allowed. Then Ramblin' Jack's motorhome, which was his predominant residence, burned down. A stroke also put an end to Elliott performing much of his regular set list due to the complex finger-picking required that wasn't possible now. One such song that he can no longer perform is Bob Dylan's Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, which Elliott first began performing in the Village in 1964 and recorded on his landmark record, Young Brigham. Dylan enjoyed his performance so much that he stood up and exclaimed, "I relinquish her to you, Jack."
They were having an open mic down there in the Gaslight on McDougal Street, and it was Mississippi John Hurt's night off. And it was open mic, and there was the usual crowd was assembled. There was Dave Van Ronk and John Wynn and Peter and Paul. Mary was out shopping, I believe. Bob Dylan was there. There were these 18 or so folk singers, friends of mine, and three unidentified tourists from New Jersey. The place was full. So I started singing, and Bob stood up in the aisle. I could barely see him, but I recognized there was a little light coming through the hole in the curtain in the back, reflected off of his halo. And I said, he stood up and he yelled, he says, "How did you do, Bob Jack?" I said, "What'd you say?" He says, "I really should do you, Jack." I said, "Oh, I'd never had anything relinquished to me before, and so I've been singing it ever since." And I hope that I could do. And it's called, darn nice song, it's called Don't Think Twice, It's All Right.
Ramblin' Jack Elliott's unprecedented life was documented by his filmmaker daughter, Ayanna Elliott, in 2000, with the release of The Ballad of Ramblin' Jack, which won a special jury prize at the Sundance Film Festival. Despite an often strained relationship, this pseudo-biographic represents a coming together of father and daughter, aided by family members, friends, and Jack's musical confidants, exploring who he is and how he got where he is. Ayanna was actually instrumental in securing a long-term road manager for Elliott after he drove from his California home to a show in Portland, Oregon, on his own at age 88. Today, at 90 years old, Ramblin' Jack Elliott is one of the last true links to the great folk traditions of this country. He suggested that money is the only reason he continues to tour, claiming that he would have retired long ago if he could have afforded it. However, his biography states that he's still seeking those people, places, songs, and stories that are handcrafted, reeking of wood and canvas, cowhide and forged metal. You'll find him in the sleek lines of a long-haul semi-truck, in the rigging of an old sailing ship, and in the smell of a fine leather saddle. With over 40 albums under his belt, Ramblin' Jack Elliott is symbolic of blue-collar graft, having lived the life of the protagonists in the songs that he sings. Not only did Elliott not in a pause manage to become the cowboy that he so desperately wanted to be, but he also learned the blues firsthand from the likes of Lead Belly, Mississippi John Hurt, the Reverend Gary Davis, Big Bill Brunzy, and Brownie McGee, and has been a direct influence on countless others, including Bob Dylan, Jerry Jeff Walker, Guy Clark, and the Grateful Dead, just to name a few. This story was written by Jack Browning. Now here's a rendition of a traditional tune that Ramblin' Jack made his own, as he did many others, called Roving Gambler, first collected in America in 1909, with origins possibly linked to a 19th century English folk song called The Journeyman, or The Roving Journeyman.
I'm a roving gambler, whenever I meet with a deck of cards, I lay my money down. Boys, I lay my money down. I gambled up in Washington, I gambled down in Maine. I'm on my way to Georgia to knock down my last game. Boys, I knocked down my last game. I've been in Washington many more weeks than three, when I fell in love with a pretty girl, she fell in love with me. Boy, she fell in love with me. Took me in her parlor, she cooled me with her fan. She whispered low in her mama's ear, love this gambling man. I love this gambling man. Daughter, my dear daughter, how can you treat me so? To leave a poor mama dear with this chemical, born with this chemical. Mama, my dear mama, you know I love you well. The love I hold for the gambling man, no human tongue can tell. No human tongue can tell. I never met no farmer, he's always in the rain. I'd rather marry a gambling man with a big old watch and chain. Mine with a big old watch and chain. Never did see no railroad man wouldn't tell his wife a lie. Mine wouldn't tell his wife a lie. Hear the train a-coming, coming round the curve. Whistling and I'm blowing, stretching every nerve. Mine is stretching every nerve. Goodbye, mama, tell you if I can. If you ever see me home again, I'll be with a gambling man. I'll be with a gambling man.
Season 2 is finally here, and there is so much music history to uncover, which also means there's a lot of work to be done. Would you be willing to help this independent program with a monthly donation of at least $5? I know it's a lot to ask when it's currently free for you to listen, but it can go a long way, I assure you. Please visit patreon.com/AmericanSongcatcher. That's patreon.com/AmericanSongcatcher.
'Cause we're together again.
Born to a military family stationed in Birmingham, Alabama, Emmylou Harris came into the world on April 2, 1947. Her father was a decorated Marine Corps pilot who spent 16 months as a prisoner of war after his plane was shot down in Korea during the early 1950s. As most military families do, they moved a great deal during Emmylou's childhood before landing in Woodbridge, Virginia, where she went to school at the recently desegregated Garfield Senior High School. She was a model child, a saxophonist in the marching band, cheerleader, winner of the Miss Woodbridge Beauty Pageant, winner of the History Award, the English Award, the Scholarship Award, the Essay Contest, and she graduated high school as class valedictorian. "I never went on dates. I never did anything," she said. "I studied and I was very intense. I was fairly sure something was wrong with me."
At birth, mama, papa called little boy Ned, raised him on the bank of the river bed.
After winning a dramatic scholarship at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, Emmylou began to seriously study music. Back on her 16th birthday, her grandfather bought a $30 K guitar at a pawn shop, and Emmylou's brother, Walter, introduced her to country music and Buck Owens. Though she claimed that she was still weirdly introverted through college, she got on stage for the first time and performed her own version of Buck's Louisiana Man. It was the 60s, and Emmylou easily found her way into learning folk songs from Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Peter Paul and Mary, and Pete Seeger, and soon she was performing at the local bars and clubs. By 1967, she dropped out of UNC and enrolled at Boston University. Once in the Northeast, she was so drawn to what had transpired in the Greenwich Village folk scene in New York City that she decided to move there instead.
Bobby's gone to California. I won't see her anymore. Bobby's gone to California, like she did the year before.
Though the psychedelic era had mostly taken over and the folk music community was dying off, Emmylou grinded out the Greenwich Village club circuit and became a regular at Gertie's Folk City, where she struck up friendships with Jerry Jeff Walker, David Bromberg, and Paul Seibel. She got a job as a waitress and met her future husband, songwriter Tom Slocum, and they were married in 1969. Emmylou's debut LP, Gliding Bird, came out in 1970, but shortly after the record's release, the label declared bankruptcy. She also happened to be pregnant with their first child, and her marriage was falling apart. They moved to Nashville and divorced soon afterwards, where she would raise her daughter Hallie on her own. She struggled there and hit a breaking point and decided to move back in with her parents, who lived on a farm outside of Washington, D.C. She said, "Washington, D.C., oddly enough, is a very, very musical town. It has a lot of bluegrass and a lot of young people and a lot of clubs that love to have music. You could play 3 or 4 different clubs per week and make a fair wage, enough to support yourself, which I never could do in New York."
It wasn't God who made honky tonk angels, as you said in the words of your song.
Gradually, Emmylou built up a small following and respect from local musicians. She got a job waitressing 3 days a week and would do several nights performing 3 sets in a row for next to nobody. One night in 1971, she had just finished playing, and a friend came by along with 2 members of the country rock pioneer group, the Flying Burrito Brothers, Rick Roberts and Kenny Wirtz. Her friend suggested that she play again, and Emmylou reluctantly played one of the first country songs that she learned. It wasn't God who made honky tonk angels. They wanted her to join the group, but instead suggested her to Graham Parsons, who had just left the outfit and wanted a female vocalist for his Cosmic American Music solo project. They had an instant connection, and Emmylou started a mentorship learning about country music history, singing harmony on Graham's solo debut record, and joining his backup group, the Fallen Angels, on tour. The following year, Emmylou was back in the studio with Graham for his next album, Grievous Angel. A few weeks after the sessions ended, tragedy struck when Graham was found dead in his hotel room in Joshua Tree, California. An autopsy revealed his fondness for drugs and alcohol, which had caught up with him and caused a heart attack. Emmylou was devastated. She had been in D.C. when she received the news.
There's the mythic Graham, who was famous for dying young, but the fact is that Graham had his pulse on something.
From that point on, she dedicated herself to keeping the flame alive for Graham. She stayed in D.C. and formed the Angel Band before signing to Reprise Records and relocating to Los Angeles. Emmylou's major label debut came in 1975, titled Pieces of the Sky, made up of a collection of diverse covers ranging from Merle Haggard to Rodney Crowell to Dolly Parton to the Beatles. And her rendition of the Louvin Brothers classic, If I Could Only Win Your Love, became her first top five hit.
If I could only win your love, I'd make the most of everything.
Soon afterward, Emmylou put out a Christmas single called Light of the Stable, with a star-studded backing vocals cast and Dolly Parton, Linda Ronstadt, and Neil Young. Her second LP, 1976's Elite Hotel, featured Elvis Presley's sidemen James Burton and Glenn D. Hardin, as well as a young songwriter named Rodney Crowell on backup vocals and rhythm guitar. She covered Buck Owens's Together Again and Patsy Cline's Sweet Dreams, which both topped the charts. She also sang harmony on Bob Dylan's record Desire, and appeared in Martin Scorsese's film of the band's legendary final performance, The Last Waltz. Rounding out the 70s was her third record, Quarter Moon and a 10-Cent Town, led by her third number one single, Two More Bottles of Wine, followed by her first step into acoustic roots music and bluegrass with 1979's Blue Kentucky Girl.
Just come on home to your blue Kentucky girl.
The 80s marked the start of several experiments that galvanized Emmylou's authenticity. She had a top 10 duet with Roy Orbison, That Lovin' You Feelin' Again, as well as covers of Donna Summer's On the Radio, Johnny Ace's Pledging My Love, and Sandy Denny's Old Fashioned Waltz. She moved back to Nashville and began working on The Ballad of Sally Rose, which was an autobiographical take on her life that was a commercial failure, but an artistic achievement. The record Angel Band was a stripped-down collection of traditional country spirituals, and she teamed up with Dolly Parton and Lynn Ronstadt once again for 1987's Trio, which has been her best-selling album to date.
To know him is to love him.
In a move that shows the many levels of Emmylou's advocacy and attention to preservation, in 1991, she recorded a live album, At the Ryman, with her acoustic group, the Nash Ramblers. At the time, the Ryman Auditorium was in shambles, having seldom been used since its many years housing the Grand Ole Opry, which had moved to another location on the other side of town. The album helped bring attention back to the old building, and soon it was restored and reopened as a music venue, and is still going strong today. Though she's been dubbed the queen of country rock, Emmylou Harris has managed to seamlessly weave folk, pop, rock, country, and western while adding old-time sensibilities and unique phrasing in her signature sound. She's one of the most admired women, not only in contemporary country music, but beyond, responsible for influencing prominent female singers, including Mary Chapin Carpenter, Deanna Carter, the Dixie Chicks, Patti Loveless, Trisha Yearwood, Iris DeMent, Patti Griffin, Nancy Griffith, Lucinda Williams, and many others who regularly cite her. She's recorded with Bob Dylan, Tammy Wynette, Dolly Parton, Steve Earle, Neil Young, Lyle Lovett, Roy Orbison, The Pretenders, The Band, Willie Nelson, Ryan Adams, Beck, Elvis Costello, Johnny Cash, George Jones, and many other well-known musicians. She's won 12 Grammys, was inducted into the Alabama Music Hall of Fame in 2003, the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2008, and in 2018, she received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. Here's my rendition of an old gospel song called Angels Rejoiced Last Night, inspired by both the duo who wrote it in 1958, the Louvin Brothers, as well as a version by Emmylou and Graham Parsons in 1976.
The house not a home,
was a picture Satan painted for sweet little sister and me. Our daddy would frown, our mother was praying. His heart was so hardened that he could not believe. In anger he'd swear, his voice was cold and loud. Sundays were spent out with the gambling crowd. I've never seen my daddy inside a house of God. For Satan held his hand down the path of sin he trod. Not long ago, a circle was broken when God called a brother one night. In a voice sweet and low, last words were spoken, asking our daddy to raise a children right. The angels rejoiced in heaven last night. I heard my daddy praying, dear God, make it right. He was smiling in a singing with tears in his eyes. Mother, with the angels, rejoice last night.
Oceanside, California, on February 20th, 1981, Christopher Scott Thiele was raised in a musical and Christian household. His father was a piano tuner and a jazz bassist, though by the time that Chris was born, he had slowed down his playing. Chris heard music constantly in the house as a child, and his earliest musical memory was listening to Stan Getz's recording of The Girl from Ipanema before he was even 1 year old. He also recalled hearing songs by the Kingston Trio and a tape that his parents had of Flatt and Scruggs, particularly Earl Scruggs' version of Sally Ann, loving the sound of his pioneering banjo playing. By age two, his family started going to a local spot called That Pizza Place, where he listened to John Moore's band, Bluegrass, etc., who performed there every Saturday night. It was around this time that Chris started begging his parents for a mandolin. However, they didn't have the knowledge about which mandolin would suit him, nor could they afford one anyways. But finally, when he was five, a friend of the family gave him what he called a crappy Delta mandolin, and he never looked back. Chris played all the time, and his parents fostered his creativity by giving him space to explore and encouraging him without force. He found quite quickly that the more that he played, the more he was able to mimic his musical heroes and understand what they were doing. He listened to the great players like David Grisman, Sam Bush, and John Reichman, and was also a keen observer of what fiddle players were doing with their tone. He discovered the emotion of classical piano as well as Bela Fleck's virtuosic banjo playing, and before long, he had a cultured musical landscape to draw from. His family continued going to the bluegrass sessions at That Pizza Place, and Chris began taking occasional lessons from John Moore, who never let him know how impressed he was. John wasted no time in getting five-year-old Chris on stage at least twice a month to play on a song, as he did with a few other grade school musicians who were showing promise. "I was too young to be nervous. I thought, oh, this is what you get to do when you're five," Chris said. Before long, the Thieles were driving to bluegrass festivals around the country in the family camper, where Chris was soaking up more music, learning to play better with others, and and winning championships. For years, he continued performing at that pizza place, and among those who he shared the stage with was brother and sister Sean and Sarah Watkins, on guitar and fiddle respectively. That's where they met in 1988. Sean was 12, Sarah and Chris were both 7.
Where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
Encouraged by John Moore, the three were jamming in the back hallway of that pizza place and finding a connective thread between them. They started performing at street fairs and art galleries and made their official debut under the name Nickel Creek at the Lake Henshaw Bluegrass Festival in 1989, with Chris's father Scott playing upright bass. Many more California bluegrass festivals followed, and the three were homeschooled to accommodate their scheduling. They were said to be officially discovered while playing at the Gene Autry Museum in Los Angeles in the late summer of 1992, which led to their first record, Little Cowpoke, made up mostly of old cowboy traditionals and a few bluegrass numbers, released in 1993. Chris and Sarah were 12, and Sean was 17 by this time. That same year, Chris made a demo tape and sent it to Sugar Hill Records, who offered him a contract and released his first solo album, Leading Off, an all-instrumental record featuring mostly original compositions. 2 years later, in 1995, Chris's father Scott accepted a position at Murray State University as a musical instrument technician, and the family moved to Murray, Kentucky. Despite the distance, things picked up instead of slowing down, and by 1997, he released another instrumental record titled Stealing Second, while Nickel Creek put out Here to There. Chris also enrolled at Murray State University in 1996, where he majored in music and modern languages for a year and a half.
Forward many a mile to go that night before he reached the town. Oh, down, oh, down, oh, many a mile to go that night before he reached the town. Oh.
By this point, Nickel Creek had been somewhat quiet, steadily making the rounds on the festival circuit for over a decade, building a slow buzz. As luck would have it, Bluegrass Hall of Famer Alison Krauss happened to be at one of their shows, and after meeting her, she agreed to produce their next album. When that self-titled record was released in 2000, the word about Nickel Creek was out, and the group finally earned national acclaim. The album went platinum, and they were given 2 Grammy Award nominations for Best Bluegrass Album and Best Country Instrumental for the song Ode to a Butterfly. They were also nominated by the Country Music Awards for Best Vocal Group and were named one of the 5 Music Innovators of the Millennium by Time Magazine in 2000. Following Nickel Creek's major success, Chris released his 3rd solo record, Not All Who Wander Are Lost, in 2001, featuring collaborations with some of the top names in bluegrass, and Stuart Duncan, Bela Fleck, Edgar Meyer, Jerry Douglas, and Brian Sutton, which made an appearance in the top 20 bluegrass charts. Nickel Creek was also invited by Dolly Parton to perform as her backup band at the 2001 Grammy Awards. By the following year, all members were in their 20s. They cashed in again when they released This Side, also produced by Alison Krauss, this time going gold and winning a Grammy for Best Contemporary Folk Album, and solidifying their place as the most progressive bluegrass act in the early 2000s. In 2004, ever eager to push the envelope, Chris released his 4th solo record, Deceiver, an experimental work on which he recorded every track himself, and earned a Grammy nomination for Best Engineered Album, Non-Classical. In 2005, after tours with Gillian Welch and David Rollins, John Mayer, and Lyle Lovett, Nickel Creek released Why Should the Fire Die, gearing more towards indie rock and pop influences while still receiving critical acclaim and selling 500,000 records. However, in 2006, after more than 15 years together, Nickel Creek announced that they were dismembering after their tour in 2007, I would not be recording as a group indefinitely. After splitting up, each member pursued other musical endeavors. Chris released one of his most acclaimed solo records, How to Grow a Woman from the Ground. Sarah Watkins collaborated with Led Zeppelin's John Paul Jones, who acted as producer for her self-titled 2009 solo debut. The same year, her brother Sean Watkins formed a duo called Fiction Family with the frontman from Switchfoot, John Foreman. Towards the end of 2006, Chris was out with some friends named Gabe Witcher, Chris Eldridge, Greg Garrison, and Noam Pickleney. As he explained, "We got together one night just to drop a ton of money, drink too much wine, eat steaks, and commiserate about our failed relationships. We had said that we needed to do something musical together. With our hearts smashed to pieces, it became more urgent. Our lives had gone the same way for so long. We played, and there was a serious, instantaneous connection. Then I knew I wanted to put together a bluegrass band, one with a lot of range, but aesthetically, a bluegrass band." The group started as the Tensions Mountain Boys. Though the guitarist, Chris Critter Eldridge, who studied under Tony Rice, had prior commitments to the infamous String Dusters, a group that he helped found. So they changed their name to How to Grow a Band with guitarist Brian Sutton before going back to the Tensions Mountain Boys when Critter returned. However, their management, record company, and even fans thought the name wasn't great. They landed on Punch Brothers, which came straight from a Mark Twain short story called Punch Brothers, Punch.
Rye whiskey makes the band sound better, makes your baby cuter, makes herself taste sweeter. Oh boy, rye whiskey.
At Carnegie Hall in 2007, the group debuted a collection of four movements called The Blind Leaving the Blind from their debut record, Punch, which Chris had written in part to deal with a divorce 3 years earlier. They spent nearly all of 2008 touring, and as if he wasn't already busy enough, in the fall of that year, Chris collaborated with bassist Edgar Meyer for their self-titled debut album, and toured in support of it. Chris said, "Edgar is one of the biggest influences on my musical life, and now I'm in a duo with him and writing songs with him. This was my dream. I always wondered what it would be like to be playing music this hard." The Punch Brothers then released their second effort, Anti-Phogmatacy, in 2010, continuing to tour and adding an appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman, with Steve Martin joining on banjo. In 2011, Chris teamed up with the unique all-star cast for the Goat Rodeo Sessions, including cello virtuoso Yo-Yo Ma, bluegrass fiddler Stuart Duncan, Edgar Meyer on bass, and an appearance by Aoife O'Donovan of both Crooked Still and I'm With Her. All Grammy winners in their own right, the album was, as quoted on Yo-Yo Ma's website, "genre-breaking sound that's part composed, part improvised, and uniquely American. The music is so difficult to pull off, the group likens it to a goat rodeo. An aviation term for a situation in which 100 things need to go right to avoid disaster." This was only one of many collaborations that awarded Chris with the MacArthur Fellowship Grant in 2012, a $500,000 genius grant given to individuals who show exceptional merit and promise for continued and enhanced creative work.
Between in the night and day, I'm gonna see the one I open from now on.
Since 2005, Chris has been performing as a duo with guitarist and vocalist Michael Daves, who we met at a bluegrass jam at New York City's Bagot Inn. Their debut album, Sleep With One Eye Open, was recorded at Jack White's studio in 2011, who also produced the record, consisting of 16 classic bluegrass duets nominated for the Best Bluegrass Album by the Grammys. Punch Brothers released their third album, Who's Feeling Young Now, in early 2012, and in 2014, Chris collaborated with Edgar Meyer once again, for bass and mandolin, winning a Grammy for Best Contemporary Instrumental. That same year, Nickel Creek reunited to release a new album called A Dotted Line in celebration of their 25th anniversary. The group also embarked on a 24-date national tour titled NC25, one of which was at the Fox Theater in Oakland, California on May 19, 2014, and was released in 2020 as the album Live from the Fox Theater.
I hear that old piano from down the avenue. I smell the roses, I look around for you.
Chris first appeared on the famed public radio show A Prairie Home Companion, hosted by Garrison Keillor in 1996 when he was just 15, and returned numerous times as a solo artist with Nickel Creek and the Punch Brothers, in addition to being guest host several times. In July of 2015, Keillor officially announced that he was leaving the show, after a bout of health issues and eventual firing due to what was deemed inappropriate behavior, and chose Chris Thiele to succeed him as his permanent host starting in 2016. Keeler said, "There just isn't anything he can't do, and he is very enthusiastic about live radio." While Chris added, "I grew up with this show. I take this opportunity, this job, immensely seriously and with great awe." After the first season, Chris announced in late 2017 that the show is being renamed to Live From Here. Though after three successful seasons, the producers at American Public Media were tragically forced to cancel the program due to the effect on attendance at live shows from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Land your sky, your sea.
In June of 2021, Chris released his first truly solo album with just his voice and his mandolin, titled Lay Songs. The six original songs and three covers touch on Chris's ideas of spirituality. He said, "It is a lifelong obsession of mine, even post-Christianity, what the impact of that kind of devotion to any organized religion is." The pandemic had finally afforded Chris the time to both conceive the idea and make the record, and his wife, accomplished actress Claire Coffey, acted as co-producer. "She has incredible taste and narrative intuition," Chris said. "She was able to help me weave the original and non-original material together."
Hear ourselves sing, my oh my, what a wonderful day we're having,
Chris Thiele is considered to be one of the greatest mandolin players who has ever lived, transcending all the borders between traditional, progressive, and contemporary bluegrass, and adding a broad fluency of classical music, blues, and jazz. "I'm trying to find the middle between music that's visceral and music that's cerebral," Chris said. "I want to be transportive. I want a new perspective on what it means to be alive." In addition to already releasing over 30 albums through many projects, Chris completed his mandolin concerto in 2009, entitled Ad Astra Per Alas Porci, commissioning 7 orchestras for live performances across the country. Chris's accolades include an honorary doctorate from the New School in 2015. He's been nominated for Instrumentalist of the Year by the Americana Music Association, has been dubbed Mandolinist of the Year by the IBMAs, was awarded Folk Musician of the Year by the BBC in 2006. He's been nominated for 22 Grammys and has won 4 different times with different groups, including his duo with Edgar Meyer, the Punch Brothers, the Goat Rodeo Sessions, and Nickel Creek. Here's a rendition of Bury Me Beneath the Willow, an old traditional folk ballad first collected in 1909 and recorded by Chris Thiele and Michael Daves on their Sleep With One Eye Open record from 2011.
My heart is sad, Lord, and I am lonely, for the only one that I love. When shall I see her? Oh, never, till we meet in heaven above. Bury me beneath the willow, under the weeping willow tree, so she will know where I am sleeping, and perhaps she will weep for me. Until the angel softly whispered, she will prove untrue to you. Oh, bury me beneath the willow, under the weeping willow tree, so she will know where I am sleeping, and perhaps she will weep for me. Tomorrow was to be our wedding, Lord, where can she be? She's out a-courting with another, and no longer cares for me.
perhaps she will weep for me.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16.
That's all for episode 1 of season 2. It feels damn good to be back with y'all, and I hope you'll consider supporting this independent program and its volunteer writer staff by visiting patreon.com/AmericanSongcatcher. Also, don't forget to follow American Songcatcher on Instagram, @AmericanSongcatcher. And if you're using Apple Podcasts, please give a rating and review. It's super helpful. Today's Shine a Light goes out to the folks at the Arhuli Foundation. A nonprofit organization, the Arhuli Foundation is dedicated to the documentation, preservation, and celebration of regional roots music and its makers. Through the life's work of its founder, Chris Stockwitz, and his acclaimed independent label, Arhuli Records, they are actively broadening public awareness of America's diverse musical history. Their mission is to support the vitality of living traditions and reinforce the value and sustainability of community-based cultures through educational outreach, live performances, and direct support to artists. Visit arhuli.org to find out more. Huge thanks to the community on Patreon. This would not be possible without you. To the Smithsonian Folkways for all their crucial work in preserving the legacy of these artists and these songs. Cultural Equity in the work of the Lomax family for all the historical documentation you've shared with the world, Library of Congress's complete National Recording Registry and Archive of Folk Song. The intro song is Payday by Mississippi John Hurt from the Today album. The outro song is 16 Tons, performed by Tennessee Ernie Ford, originally written by Merle Travis. This episode was produced, researched, edited, recorded, and distributed by myself, Nicholas Edward Williams, with writing assistance from Jack Browning. In the words of Ramblin' Jack Elliott, I just did what I did best and found the songs and interpreted them the way that they suited me. Here's to the songs of old. May they live on forever. See you next time on American Songcatcher.
I owe my soul to the company store.